So first of all, do you want like some eye shades? Yes, because if you get light in your eyes, these are really good, courtesy of Singapore Airlines, for covering your eyes. There's lots more of these if you need them, but we'd like one? Because you had the toilet covered this morning. Anyone else want one? I'll just leave it up here. We've got lots more, courtesy of Singapore Airlines. So they give them out and I just collect them to use for when people do the meditation. Okay, never mind. And not only that, is that sometimes if the light bothers you in the morning time, or that sometimes that we have things happen in meditation where you're not really sure, is this a nimitta? Or is this some lights from somewhere in the room over here? Or is it just the moon or the sun shining through the windows? And you put those on, it makes it quite clear that it cannot be anything else but a nimitta. And there's another phenomenon which sometimes happens when people get to that stage, the light is very strong in the eyes, and it's like a nimitta. Sometimes the eyelids start to flicker. They flutter, they go up and down. It's just the habit which we have from our brain of seeing light, not sure if it is light, if it's very strong. And that fluttering of the eyelids can sometimes be a bit of a distraction. It's not that common, but it does happen. And so the solution is the iPads. The iPads or the eye shades, whichever you wish to call them. They're usually called eye shades in places like Australia. But in the United States, they're called iPads. Which is one of the reasons why, where is she now, Burr? She came and asked me for an iPad. She said, ask me for an iPad? I don't have any iPads. I've got a tablet. And she said, no, you've got lots of iPads. I said, I don't. She said, you have. And she looked at these. These are iPads. So to continue the story, then I went up to one of the monks and said, oh, do you want an iPad? And he said, well, wait now, what type? He said, you? When I gave it to him, he said, ooh, yeah. But anyway, so they're very useful for meditation. So to put over your eyes. And then it solves a lot of problems with any sort of visual problems you have in meditation. Too much light, or you want to make sure it is a nimitta, or you have the fluttering in the eyelids. Which can sometimes happen. So underneath here, have you done this stuff yet? No, not yet. No, we'll just leave it alone. There was the message, not the message last night, but the question, which I didn't have a chance to finish on, was the difference between samadhi and the first jhana. So it sort of fits in with the talk today. But samadhi is a general term, and it is, people use the word concentration in a sense. The mind is unified into a very powerful place, but concentration, again, it does really imply that you've done a lot of work, a lot of force to actually to concentrate it. But the other way of calling it is calling it stillness. And stillness not only is a more accurate description of the phenomena which we call the jhanas or samadhi, but it also makes it very clear of the path you need to take to actually to allow the mind to be still. And this is a simile which I often do. And so because you are closest, could you come up please a moment? Now, you can just sit down comfortably. Now, are you an honest gentleman?
No.
Well, today you are. Okay. Of course you are. Now, what I want you to do, my job, my quest here is to get this water to be perfectly still. So has it stopped moving yet? Have a look at the water. Has it stopped moving yet?
No.
I know, why is that? Because I'm not paying any attention. I'm not being mindful. And I'll be mindful of the water. Has it stopped moving yet?
No.
No, good. So now, what's the problem here? I'm mindful, but I'm not concentrating. I'll now be mindful and concentrate. I just stopped moving yet. No. I'm really trying to hold it still, honestly. But when I'm concentrating, mindful, I just can't keep this still. And the reason for that is that it's physically impossible, because even the muscles which are in your arm, the metabolism, they're always moving. They have to be. So, how can I get this water to be perfectly still and achieve my aim? Put it down. Let it go. Stop grasping. Stop attaching. Stop holding on. Renounce. Take it easy. Be kind. Is that still moving? It actually is. I better stop moving.
After some time.
Yeah. How long is that now?
Stop.
Stop, yes. So you're not just making this up just to please me, are you? It really is stop. I didn't pay you beforehand, I didn't bribe you. Okay, thank you. A round of applause for my assistant this morning. I want to play you out. But the message is very clear. That if you want things to become still, trying to make them still, holding on to it, concentrating, you never achieve any type of stillness at all. Which means that you can understand why so many times when you're meditating, you've been meditating year in, year out, and still it's not still. Why? Because you're trying. So learn how to put things down. Let them go. And it becomes still all by itself. And that's where we got to yesterday with that delightful breath and the starts of nimittas coming up in the journey of the thousand petal lotus opens up. That simile again is useful because it shows all the way into the deepest parts of that lotus. It's all the same things which, you know, you're doing. If you're not really doing, you're just being aware and being kind. Mindfulness and kindness all the way through. It's not as if you get to a certain level and then you stop and do something else. You change your tactics, you change your way of doing stuff. All the time, mindfulness, kindness, right through the deepest meditations. That's all you ever do. And when you're mindful and kind, you let things be. Stillness happens all by itself. So, we get delightful breath comes up. If you don't sort of disturb the process, it's going to happen anyway. You get sort of delight. And sometimes people sometimes don't realize how quiet and delightful they become because we're in this place together and we just grow together in our deep meditation. There was one gentleman here during the rains retreat a few years ago, and he thought he was getting nowhere in his meditation until, as the skillful means, I sent him into the local shopping center, the shopping mall, to get something. I could have got somebody else to get that, so whatever it was, but I decided to send him to the shopping mall. And when he went into the shopping mall, he came back afterwards and said, "That's a crazy world out there." He said, "Yeah, you used to live in there, didn't you? And now you've found out just how peaceful you've become." He had something to, if you like, compare it to. And so often on a 9-day retreat, you don't realize just how peaceful you are becoming after a few days. You get used to it. But you have already got far more peaceful than when you first came here. And number two is give it a few more days and you find the mind starts to brighten up. If you are just meditating on the chairs, on the stools, on the cushions and keep on working, still that's hard work. You're not relaxing enough. Which is one of the reasons why I suggested to people to sit outside the dining room with a cup of tea. Even if you don't drink the tea, that's not the point. You're just sitting there doing nothing, enjoying the beautiful scenery there. You're not doing anything. You're relaxing. Or just in your bed, just on your back and just relaxing the body. Or on the stupas, just sitting down there watching the beautiful view. These are all places where you're not really think you're achieving anything or doing anything. And because you're not doing anything, you're not trying to get somewhere, your mind can relax. It starts to become still. You put down the quest of meditation. You stop traveling towards meditation. And then meditation happens. It brings me up to one of the key sayings. This is from Visuddhimagga, a very classic Buddhist text on meditation. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Enlightenment is, but no person enters it. And what does that mean? The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. If you try to travel this path, if you try to make jhana happen, it will never happen. You are traveling that path. And an example of that, and it also gets me out of a lot of problems, because often people ask, I've already had one question, Ajahn Brahm, can you please tell me about your previous lives? And I just, you know, made a sort of the escape that, oh, you mean when before I was a monk, my life before I was a monk. But then again, somebody might say, no, Ajahn Brahm, you meant before you were born. Who were you before? Can you tell us about your previous existences? Can you tell me about your psychic powers? Can you please do a psychic power? Just once, you know, some real big one. But there is a rule, we're not allowed to actually display such things in public. We're not even allowed to tell about any attainments we have. We're not allowed to say if we can attain jhanas. So sometimes when people ask me, come on Ajahn Brahm, you write about it, you teach it, you know, can you actually do it? And if I keep saying, oh, I'm not allowed to say, people say, oh yeah, that's just a trick, you can't do it. So, some years ago, kind of a couple of years ago, I decided that because I know all the loopholes, where you can get around these things without breaking your precepts. So one day I told people, I said, okay, I confess, I said, Ajahn Brahm can't enter jhana. And people looked at me. Fraud! Deceit! You wrote all these books and you teach jhanas and you can't enter it? And I said, Ajahn Brahm can't enter jhanas. Ajahn Brahm has to disappear first. And then jhanas happen. So straight away, it's a lot, sort of a loophole. You're not sort of making a claim. I'm not saying I can enter jhanas. But it's a type of a loophole. I think you just about get away with that with a good lawyer. But it also makes the teaching point that you cannot enter jhanas. You have to let this idea of a self-attainment, me doing it, vanish. And then these things are more likely to happen. So there's no one even, Suvadi can't enter jhanas. But if Suvadi vanishes, then the jhanas might happen. So this is what it serves two purposes. One, it gets me out of a sticky situation when you ask me all these questions. And number two, it tells you exactly how these things happen. You have to stop giving those instructions. You have to stop doing it. You have to sort of butt out, step aside, and let these things happen. So, there you are, delightful breath, having a wonderful time. Relax and disappear. It's a great thing to have a beautiful breath, breathing in, breathing out. Oh, it's a great time. Stop controlling, stop doing, stop calling the shots, stop driving the meditation vehicle. Automatic pilot, let go. That's what letting go means. Let go of the controls and let just the momentum of the meditation just be. People sometimes ask me, what's the difference between letting go and letting be? Letting go is you're letting go of wanting, letting go of time, letting go of doing stuff, and what's remaining, that is what you let be. You don't try and change it. It's here, let it be. And little by little, you find as it calms down, the delightful breath begins, the delight, the energy, the mindfulness starts to increase. Two parts to the mind in this simile. First part of the mind is your knowing, mindfulness. The second part is the doer, doing stuff. And it's amazing because of our upbringing, because of the demands of our lifestyle, that we do so much. We're always doing something to the point that the doing, planning, executing what your plans are, worrying, thinking, all of that active part of your mind takes up the vast proportion of your energy. 95, 98, 99% of your energy gets used in doing things. Knowing, being aware, being mindful takes only the remainders, the leftovers. Which is one of the reasons why when people do a lot, they get tired. Their mindfulness is very low. And when they really get into a difficulty and they struggle to escape, their mindfulness gets so weak, it has a special name. Depression. If you've ever experienced depression, you should look at the beautiful dawn. See that before. You go and taste the delicious food. Not enough chili. You go and listen to one of Ajahn Brahm's hilarious jokes. Everything is grey, tasteless. Nothing can actually stimulate you because you've got such low energy because you're tired out. That's one of the reasons depression is just incredibly low mindfulness. And the jokes are still funny. You didn't agree? Oh dear. About the psychiatrist, the guy comes into his rooms and says, what's your problem? He says, I'm a dog. I think I'm a dog. And he said, get on the couch. And he said, no, I'm not allowed. I've got a few little laughs. But then we have the, when the depression is there, it's a sign of low energy. But on a meditation retreat, you're not doing anything, you're not having to live up to anything. There's no exams, there's no tests, you don't have to please anybody. You can sleep whenever you want, you don't have to get up at a certain time. You know, you're not going to get told off, you know, when you come here late or you come here early. You're not getting criticized at all. You can just be on this retreat. Even, I know, birds in the corner here, even if you don't like the retreat and you ask for your money back, you'll still be invited back next time. So there's no cost. It's this beautiful sense of freedom. And don't have to live up to anything. Isn't that wonderful? Taking that, so for some people that's weird. I mean, I don't have to do anything? No. And then sometimes it gets so difficult not doing anything, you volunteer for extra chores. Because you're not used to actually not doing anything. Being useless. What a wonderful thing it is to be useless. To actually not to achieve anything, not to do anything, to be lazy, just to relax. What does that do to your sense of ego and self? Have a useless weekend. What did you do in the weekend? Nothing much. So you're wasting your time. Well, that's a nice use of time. You got time? How about wasting some? Is it really wasting it? Or is it just going against the way that people look at this world and trying something new, thinking outside the box? Just relaxing, letting it go. And after a while, you find your mindfulness starts to increase. The doer doesn't gobble up all the energy. The knower starts to get a share of the energy. And the knower starts to become more powerful. You begin to be more aware. And I say, with the awareness gets strong, it looks so beautiful. This world, everything starts, and because it starts to look happy, even the breath. I mean, how can a breath be delightful? It's just breath. It goes in and goes out, that's it. And what's the point of the breath? It goes in and goes out. Whether I watch it, doesn't watch it, it still does the same thing. So, but then when you start to be aware of it, it is delightful. You see so much of it, and it's incredible. And it's, obviously some of you have achieved, experienced delightful breathing. Oh, this is nice. Oh, oh, the delightful breath. And so once the delightful breath, the insight, where does that delight come from? And for those of you who have gone through other courses and look at the Anapanasati, they say this is the 5th, 6th, 7th stages of the Anapanasati. You breathe in and out, experiencing joy, and the 5th, breathe in and out, experiencing sukha, breathing in and out, experiencing the citta sankhara, the mind created effect of piti sukha. This comes from the mind. It's where the mind looks at things. It's what the mind adds on to stuff. It looks beautiful. This is actually where, you see, somewhat the Buddha said, sometimes you practice and you experience some of this stuff, and how the Buddha described it just blows your mind at how he could put it in such an incredible way. This is the mind-created happiness. And it's real, breathing in and out, and it just really starts to get strong. And that's where you get the nimittas from. It's created by the mind. It's a mind object. So, this becomes strong and powerful. And that's one of the reasons why things get strong and powerful. People just usually blow it, and they stop trusting the path. They take control, and they start to do stuff. And that's where it all goes wrong. When a nimitta does come, it's powerful, joyful. Sometimes people think, no, they don't deserve so much happiness and bliss. That is one of the big problems. I don't know how many people, you know, because I've been teaching this a long time now, how many people come along and say, I don't deserve to be so happy. And oh, come on. You know, that you've done all this wonderful work, I've really helped you and taught you and built this retreat center for you, and there you are, the happiness is there. No, I don't deserve it. Of course you deserve the happiness. But somehow or other people think, no, not me. I don't deserve this. That's one of the reasons why part of my teachings has to be to encourage you to love yourself, to be kind to yourself, to accept happiness when it's presented to you. Expect bliss when it arrives. Let it into your heart. You allow suffering into your heart every day. But when happiness calls, not today, thank you. So this is one of the reasons why you check that out. Yeah, you deserve to be happy. So allow yourself to be really happy. And of course, when it gets very powerful, people are afraid of great power. Because it's more than you can handle. So there's only one way you have to butt out. This is what I meant to be saying last night when I got tired, when I sort of gave the simile of just going to hotel rooms and different hotel rooms, and that one which was so huge that I didn't know actually which way to get in and get out. And then I just went on to the one about, you know, in Thailand overlooking the beach. And that was just on a sidetrack. What I really wanted to say with hotel rooms is, when you first go there, you're not quite sure where you are. Those people come into Jhana Grove for the first time. Now, you'll always be a bit tense, simply because you've got to find your way around. It's unfamiliar territory. You don't know if it's the first time you've seen me, it's Ajahn Brahm. What is he really like on a retreat? Is he really fierce? Or is he just like softer than one of the teddy bears? And so, you know, when you're in your room, where it is and how it is, whether this is a scam, whether this is the real deal. So people always be a little bit tense when they first come to a new place or a new teacher. So that tightness, that tension, that fear, when you come to even a new stage of meditation, is to be expected. And then the next thing which happens, you may be afraid of nimittas, you may be afraid of coming to an interview, asking a question, but then after a while, you become familiar. You know, you've been to that room, you get to know me, you know, you allow me to open the door for you instead of the other way around, which in Asian culture is just ridiculous. You get to get used to me, and used to the place, and even used to the meditations and the happiness and the power. You get familiar with it. I should say only the old nimitta, that's what it is. And then, after familiarity, the final stage is ease, to be able to let things be. So those are almost like the three stages you go to when you encounter anything new, powerful, scary. The fear, familiarity and ease. And that's to be expected. So whenever you get to a new stage of meditation, fear will come. Just keep going there. So you get familiar with it. It's only the nimitta, and it's not dangerous. And then you're at ease with it. Once you're at ease with it, it can actually grow. You can relax into it. And so with the nimitta, the best simile came from an Ajahn Chah. And that's a simile of the still forest pool. Because I can relate to this, because even when I was a young monk, there were still some jungles around. And after 4 or 5 years as a monk, we were allowed just to go wandering off, taking everything we owned with us, and go into the jungles. And of course you were first of all afraid, because there were tigers in the jungles. And I asked Ajahn Chah, you know, are the tigers dangerous? He said no. So he never heard any case of a tiger eating a monk. But because I was skeptical and logical, I said, well, you wouldn't know, would you? There'd be nothing left of the monk, and the tiger wouldn't confess. So they wouldn't know. So it wasn't reassuring, but anyway, so off you went in there. And then when I was in those jungles, actually it was an interesting about fear in those jungles, because sometimes you would sit there, and the first part of the night, they have the cicadas making all the noises. And it's actually incredibly loud sometimes, the jungles in Asia. The forest here in Australia is just so amazingly quiet. But anyway, after the main cicadas had done their thing at dusk and had quietened down, then even the jungle in Thailand was very quiet. I remember sitting there, really quiet, just meditating, getting very, very peaceful, just watching my breath go in, breath go out. And then, of course, I heard a jungle animal in the forest. You can hear them because they crunch the leaves and break the little twigs. So, you know, I had to be careful. So mindfulness left the breath and onto the sound of the animal, just to assess it, just calmly, with wisdom. No, it's only a small animal, nothing to be afraid of. So I went back to my breath. Another minute or two, now the sound was obviously coming closer to me, and it was actually, you know, quite loud. And so I left my breath again and just attended to the sound of this jungle animal. So, you know, it's in the dark, you couldn't see anything, just to figure out, you know, whether it was dangerous or not. No, It was maybe the size of a little civet cat, or maybe a mouse deer or something. Just medium-sized animals, but still not dangerous at all. So I went back to my breathing. And of course, as it came closer and closer, it got louder. And it got easier to actually to listen to, because it was actually quite loud. It was coming straight towards me. And so I left my breathing and went to the sound, and I was in trouble. This was a big animal. Only big animals could make that noise. And so I was afraid it could be, there's bears in those jungles. And there was elephants, and especially the small elephants, the baby elephants. They were really dangerous because they would want to play with you. And because they were just naughty. But then if mother saw them playing with a monk, the mother would just smash the monk to bits out of fear. So I remember Ajahn Chah telling me this. If a little baby elephant comes to play with you, don't play with it. Because, you will get killed. Instead, he said, just hit it on the tip of its trunk. Oh, you can't, little baby. No, hit it on the tip of the trunk. Because that hurts. And the baby will go away. Otherwise, the mother will come and hit you. I thought, Ajahn Chah was not compassionate at all. But anyway, that was the lessons they would tell everybody. But then, so this was a big animal. Could have been a tiger. So, of course, I opened my eyes, I got my flashlight out and looked for it. Couldn't see a tiger anywhere, no elephant. But I heard the noise and put my flashlight on it. You know what it was? A tiny mouse. About this big. And that taught me a big lesson. It was only a tiny mouse, but in the dark, when I let fear invade my mind, a tiny mouse sounded like a monk eating tiger. I'll never forget that, just how fear amplifies and exaggerates things and makes it far bigger than what's actually out there. So mouse became a tiger just because of fear. But anyway, he said sometimes, you always have to try and find some water somewhere in the late afternoon to wash. It's very sticky in the jungles. And, wash some robes and also get some water for drinking. You used to carry a little flask, canteen, so you could fill it full of water for drinking during the day and at night time. So you find some, a lake, usually, or a pond, river. And there you set your little mosquito net umbrella under which you meditate and also sleep about 10, 15 meters from the edge of the lake. If it's too close to the lake, then the jungle animals might sort of see you and just give you trouble. But anyway, Ajahn Chah used to say, and this is the main part of the story, sometimes in the evening after washing and maybe washing a few robes, getting some water, setting up his mosquito net umbrella, he would sit there with his eyes open, especially on the moon nights, where you could see everything. And with his eyes open, he watched as the jungle animals came out to play. The days before National Geographic or Nature Channel or whatever other channels you have on the TV these days or on the internet, he just watched the animals come out to play. And it was delightful because the animals would come out and they'd look around and mostly they would sniff and listen because the animals' eyes were not that well developed, but their noses and their ears were. And if you ever look at the kangaroos, those ears are amazing. They can actually switch in different directions. So they can listen this way and that way at the same time. Amazing animals. But anyway, that they know something's around because of their ears move. And the animal's eyes are terrible. The kangaroo's eyes are terrible. So, but they can hear you. So if you go past them, just say some nice things to them. And then they just go back into the grass and just carry on eating, munching. But their eyes can't see very much. So anyway, the animals in the jungles, they would sniff and listen, and if they thought there was somebody watching, If Ajahn Chah said anything or just moved, they would know and they'd go back into the forest to hide. Because no matter how much you're afraid of, say, a tiger, there's been more tigers killed by human beings than there have ever been human beings killed by tigers. We're the most dangerous animal in the forest, by far. So because of that, the tigers will be terrified. If they suspected there was a human being there, they didn't know it was Ajahn Chah, they may think it's a hunter. So they would run away even though they were thirsty. But when he was really still, then they'd come out to play. And he'd watch them and said it was delightful watching the antics of little animals as they played. The corresponding story which I like to interject here was it was in a jungle up in the mountains, close to the Burmese border. But I wasn't actually sitting meditation. It was a hot season. I put out a bowl of water for the birds because there was no water around. You know, I had some water, a little kanam of water, bowl of water. And then through a knot hole in the wooden boards of my kuti, my hut, I would in the afternoon watch the animals, the little birds, as they come to actually to drink and wash in the little bowl of water. It was about this size. And I couldn't believe what I saw. But after a couple of days, these birds, big birds, small birds, different species, formed a queue. Just one after the other, just like in the arms round, Bindabat line, it's a queue, isn't there? When you have your food, the buffet. Formed a nice little queue. You know, big birds, small birds, all different colors, different species, one after the other. To actually to drink and wash. And when one bird had finished, then the next one in queue would go in and do their business. And I've never seen that within nature, nature organizing themselves and forming queues. But just like human nature, every now and again there was one proud, arrogant bird would jump the queue. And then what happened? All the other birds would get out of queue. They'd pet and beat this bird up, send him away. And then afterwards, they'd all go in the queue again, exactly where they were before. How they could organize this was amazing. And this was in a country like Thailand, not England, where you think people are proper and got... This was Asia, and they were just more organized than anything. So, people have some wonderful sort of stories about animals in nature, and just, you know, the fact that they're so close to us. So anyway, their behavior. So anyway, Ajahn Chah would watch these, oh my goodness, would watch these animals by the still forest pool, but only if he was quiet and still. But then he said, sometimes, once the ordinary animals had come out to play, sometimes he was so quiet and so still, not moving, and then some amazing animals would come out. Animals which he never thought existed. Animals which his teachers and parents had never told him were in the forest. Beautiful, gorgeous animals. But these were so shy, they very rarely let human beings see them. They too would come out from the forest, look around and sniff. And if Ajahn Chah even moved, even a slight amount, they would know. And they would disappear for days. But when he was totally still, they'd think that no one was watching. There was no traveler on the path. So then they would come out and play by the still forest pool. And I think many of you know that it's an archetypal symbol for the mind, the pool, the lake, a body of water. And that, Ajahn Chah, is your mindfulness, your awareness. And the animals coming out to play are the nimittas and the jhanas. They're really shy. So some of you, when you get to the really delightful breath, some people, Amazing just how common this is. You see a light, but it's up in the corner somewhere. It's shy. Just wondering whether you're ready to have a nimitta come. If you go looking for it, it runs away. It doesn't come out again for many meditations. But you just sit there, just watching your delightful breath. It's like the nimitta's poking its head out of the bushes. Are you ready for me? And if you just sit there, really still, no wanting, no control, just being aware, the nimitta usually comes and centers itself. If you try and do anything with it, yay, nimitta, yay, I've got to tell Ajahn Brahm about this, yay, this, at last, yay, I've got to tell all my friends, I got nimitta. Of course, it runs away. You never see it for days afterwards. But if you get afraid, oh, I don't think I'm ready for this. Oh, I came on this retreat just to be a little bit peaceful. I don't want to become a nun. I don't want to be enlightened. I've still got many things I want to do. But sometimes we have fear or excitement, the two biggest problems for nimittas. But how do you overcome that? Because you're meditating and a light appears and says, I mustn't be scared. You've already disturbed it. And sometimes you're excited. I'm not going to be excited. You can't stop it. Except by doing this little technique called programming your mindfulness. So this is where, if your meditation's going well and you think there's a really good chance you might get nimitta or even a jhana at the next meditation, you sit down, get yourself comfortable, and then you make a resolution in your own words, usually 3 times. If a nimitta arises, I will not get excited. If a nimitta arises, I will not be excited. If a nimitta arises, I will not be excited. Saying it 3 times to reinforce the message, paying as much attention to it as possible, then forgetting about it. You don't forget about it, it's already sort of into your brain, into your mind. And then it's amazing how well that works. The deeper the meditation, the more powerful that program is. So what happens? You're meditating there and this incredible light appears and you're about to get excited. Like an antivirus, it kicks in. You don't do it. Because you don't do it, you don't have to say anything. It's subverbal. It doesn't disturb the meditation. In fact, it stops it being disturbed. So the light has a chance to stay and play in your still mind. And of course those nimittas, you don't need to be afraid of them at all, they're amazing to stay with you. Beautiful, beautiful light. Sometimes there's a whole lot of nimittas, complicated nimittas, firework nimittas, scenery, all sorts of nimittas. And it wouldn't be Ajahn Brahm unless I told a funny story about nimittas. It was 2 or 3 years ago, doing the range retreat in my cave, meditating, good meditation, but one of the nimittas I got there was a really weird one. Not weird as scary, but weird as like totally ridiculous. Because as I was, the breath was really delightful, and as it started to fade away and a beautiful light came out, it was a yellow light. And you know they're nimittas because they're more yellow than any yellow you can see in this world. It was a blue nimitta, yeah, there's a blue jacket you're wearing there, but it's much deeper blue than that. More blue than you can ever see in this world. That's a typical sign. White, well, it's like white which has been through the washing machine and it's just whiter than white. Whiter than whiter than white. There's colors you don't see in this real world. Really pure and powerful and gorgeous. So it's an incredible yellow, but the yellow had a shape to it. And I soon recognized what that shape was. It wasn't like a moon. It was actually Garfield, the cat. I've been reading too many cartoons of Garfield on the newspapers. And that came up in the image. And as soon as I saw the image of Garfield, instantly recognisable. And I just burst out laughing. That was the end of that meditation. I think I'm the only monk who's ever had the Garfield meditation. But anyway, when the real limit has come, this is real limit, but just, I just, my sense of humour just was just too bad, and I just laughed, and so that broke the meditation. But anyway, if I was really sensible monk, I said, okay, and I'd just go for the most beautiful part in that, just let the sort of the limit just purify itself. So these become gorgeous, it's a reflection of your mind. Now this fifth sense, sixth sense, the citta, that's where you're seeing the other five senses have settled down. So the sixth sense, the mind, is becoming very manifest now. And this is one of the reasons why, whatever you've been doing in the past, you start to see, and that was of course, you know, looking at Garfield cartoons instead of reading the Digha Nikaya or something, something more monk-like. Digha Nikaya is the first set of suttas. But if you have been breaking your precepts, yeah, just, well, you know, this is, it's only just, you know, five past noon. It's only 5 minutes, isn't it? It was 5 minutes, so you eat something. Or, you know, oh, you're thirsty, you know, so you take something which wasn't really offered to you. Or, you know, people have all these self-justifying breakings of your precepts. Not really breaking, not really mean, nasty stuff, but still, that appears like just the nimitta is not as bright as it should really be. You've lost some energy. And this is where I have to mention this one, that there are some people, you know, I've known the people who've, you know, been in the our Buddhist society looking after the monks and nuns for such a long time. They're what everyone recognizes as really pure-hearted people. They never criticize anybody. Even they're always there to help you. They can drop anything, you know, just to assist. And you know, they're very smart, looking after. They know exactly just what to do and how to need to look after you. And you see them in their work. They're really wonderful people. They're pure-hearted people in this world. Never ask for anything. Never complain. Always ready to give, very kind. And those types of people, and especially if I've known them for a while, I just wait for their nimitta to arise. Because you know, there's just amazing people. And when they get a nimitta, wow, that's going to blow their nose off. This is beautiful. And of course, it's so much beauty and power, it's gorgeous. But of course they can't resist that, and they're going to get in some deep meditation afterwards. And it's, Buddha always said this, and I read it in the sutta so often, that when your meditation is empowered, backed, supported by your sila, your virtuous behavior, then it's of great power. And that's precisely the meaning of it. You know, when you are kind, you're generous, you forgive other people, you don't complain, and you see that somebody is just thirsty, you don't wait, you just go and get them a glass of water to drink. And those types of people, you know, just looking out for others. Good, pure-hearted people, they're not sort of faking it, they're not just trying to show off. Those types of people, when the nimitta comes, it's beautiful, something to really behold. Their virtue makes the nimitta powerful and beautiful. And it's so beautiful that it appears not just physical beauty, but you get so inspired and so much pity and sukha coming up, so much ecstasy. I don't know that there are some places in the world which is emotionally just so incredibly strong for me. One of those places which I like talking about is actually in the museum outside of Benares, next to the deer park in Sanat in India. Because there they have the Dhammacakka image of the Buddha. And it's a very common one. It's one which really, not here, but even in my cave, I've got a little figurine of it with a big sort of wheel behind it. And the original one was found underground and escaped the Islamic persecution and destroying all the images when that 13th century invasion. And it's in the museum. It's one of the most well photographed images of the Buddha. And I always loved that image of the Buddha when I saw in the photographs, but when you had the opportunity to actually to go there and have a look, the real one. You know, Indian museums in those days, there was no maps or guides, you know, so I had to find my own way there. And when I eventually found it at the end of a corridor, it was so breathtaking, I just cried. I don't know why, it's the only image in the world which has actually brought me to tears. I loved it. It wasn't tears of sadness. It was just incredible joy. Wow, this is beautiful. It's gorgeous. And just tears came down. And I was by myself there because I was just looking for it. But the next time I led a pilgrimage to India, I was prepared. So I was leading other people. So I decided I should behave and just restrain myself. And so as soon as I turned the corner, it was one bad thing. I couldn't help myself. It's just so inspirational. I don't know why, but that just touches me. And the third time I went there, this time I was prepared, all the hankies ready, leading other people. And you turn the corner, and it was covered with a cloth. Oh my goodness. They were painting the ceiling. And to protect this priceless statue, the work had a cloth over it. And it just tore me expectations. I expected almost one of the highlights of the trip, seeing my favorite Buddha statue. I was prepared to cry. Tell everyone, don't be embarrassed about me if I burst into tears. It's just, and I'll warn you, this is going to happen. It was covered with a cloth. Expectations, they always lead to disappointment. So, oh dear. And then, I couldn't speak any Hindi. And the worker, you know, didn't know who we were. But the worker then took the cloth off. That was so sweet to see that. And, okay, I don't know, hopefully this is inspiring you, but there was another, I don't think she'd mind me telling you this, you know, Ainsley and Barbara, when they went on their pilgrimage with me once, Barbara used to be a Christian. And, you know, after a while she just followed her husband. And when we went, you know, she was from Cornwall. And when I did a briefing, orientation before we went, and I said, look, some of these places, and this is where the Buddha got enlightened, this is where the Buddha meditated, and it's pretty clear that that's no real, he was actually there. So he got lots of energy. So some of these places, you know, like that statue, I just get really emotional, just I can't stop it. It's beautiful stuff, inspirational, but tears come out. So this might happen to you, be prepared. And Barbara, you know, she was a Christian. She said, look, it's only old ruins, that's all they are. In England, there's lots of old ruins, you know, all over the place, hundreds of years old. You don't cry when you go to Hampton Court or Windsor Castle or any of these old ruins or Tower of London. Just old ruins, that's all they are. And the first day we went into the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodh Gaya. And in the evening she came to ask forgiveness of me. I said, why? She said, because as soon as I got in there, and tears streamed down her face. She couldn't stop it. Something had really touched her very deeply. And so there's some of these things which happen, the joy. Allow that joy to happen. It's selfless. You can't control it. You're letting go. It's a pure purity of your mind. It just gets so overwhelming. You weep. It's one of the signs of pity. It's of course a form of pity, but still it's part of that joy. So when you get into the deep meditations, sometimes the tears might come down your eyes. But just let it. Just let the the body disappears much better. So when the nimitta comes, it's very powerful, very beautiful, and enjoy. Because it's so beautiful and powerful, you can't hardly feel your body anyway. Usually, the bodies are long gone because the joy of the mind is just so intense. Nimittas. Sometimes people think, most people feel it as a light, and they think, my goodness, I can't stand this light any longer. You know, it's like looking in the sun, but the sun's 1,000 times brighter than it normally is. I'm going to go blind. You don't go blind by looking at nimittas. It's a mental image, although we just interpret it as a light. So you can be as blind as you like, you never get blind at all. And if you're really worried about that, put these iPads on to prove that you're not going to go blind. Number two, this happened to me, and about two people have said they experienced the same, that sometimes, and this is a nice part, this is really gets you interested in nimittas. Sometimes I thought, no human being can take so much ecstasy and bliss and pleasure. I'm going to burst with pleasure. And you find, actually, you can always take some more pleasure. That's strange coming from a monk. Why do you think I've been a monk for such a long time, 45 years? I'm not running away from anything. I'm not a monk to hide, to escape, because I can't pay off my debts, so the police can't find me. Because I have enormous happiness being a monk, especially when you can meditate. Deep. So if that ever occurs to you, say, this is just too much, it's too much pleasure, I'm going to explode. You don't explode. Well, you do explode in a little way, but not in that way. And this was this fellow, years ago, he came here, and sometimes, you shouldn't really be doing this, but this was a special man, and you know, he was a heroin addict. And he wanted to come to Bodhinyana Monastery to see if he could basically go cold turkey. His wife was here, his beautiful wife, really supportive of him. He's a good fellow, but he took the heroin once, and that was it. He got sort of addicted, just once. And he said how hard it was. I remember what he said, 1,000 times a day he has to say no to that craving. You only have to say yes once and he's back into the addiction again. It's just a difficult, difficult life. But he was actually getting somewhere for many days. He hadn't taken any heroin. But the reason I tell the story that I was about to get into the car to go to Nolimara for the weekend to give the talks at Dhammaloka. And he came rushing towards me and just saying, look, please wait for a few moments. I've got to tell you this. He just got into a deep nimitta state, not the jhanas, but pretty close. And he said, I never thought I'd say this. Because, you know, he knew the pleasure, obviously, of sex, orgasm, but he also knew the pleasure of heroin. And he said, the pleasure of heroin is way, way more intense than the pleasures of sex. That's why it's so addictive. But he says, the pleasures of the nimittas are way, way more enjoyable than even heroin. That gives you an idea of just what we're working with here. Really intense pleasures. But they are perfectly safe. If you do get addicted to those pleasures, you become what we call a jhana junkie. And if you become a jhana junkie, that four things can happen to you, said the Buddha. And the Buddha was just right on here. He said, if anybody says that you monks, you're addicted to jhanas, meditation, you should say yes. Because that's the truth. And he said, well, what happens if you indulge and addicted to the pleasures of meditation? And the Buddha said, there's only four possibilities. Sowan, stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. Those are the only four possibilities, according to the Buddha. It's not a bad deal. That's one of the reasons I teach the jhanas. Not every one of you will achieve a jhana on this retreat, but every one of you can. Many of you won't yet, but the brainwashing is in there. You won't be able to forget it. And some of you will get close. Just getting close is great. Beautiful mind states. Don't be afraid of them. Let them just develop. But you have to disappear. That's one of the reasons why. Now, well, what insight do you get from this? Is it just indulging in pleasure? Straight away, hopefully, you've made a little connection. A light bulb should have lit up there. Ajahn Brahm can't enter jhanas. Ajahn Brahm has to disappear, first of all. You have to disappear. You have to experience a sense of non-self. The more you are, the less likely there is of getting into a jhana. The more you do, the more you send those beautiful nimitta animals back into the jungle. But when you can just totally let go, disappear, there's no one at home, no one there, anatta, there the path into jhana is like a wide highway with no traffic. Easy as pie. There we go. I still haven't talked about the jhanas yet, but samadhi and first jhana. Sometimes the first jhana, the first time you experience the deep meditation, you're blissed out, you're not there, and sometimes people take that as being enlightenment itself, a holy person. From all that I've read, and again, you've got the translation is something which is difficult, that in the, did seem, that in the 13th century there was two Christian mystics, St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, who seemed to have got into the first jhanas. Teresa of Avila would actually levitate. She'd go floating up into the rafters, and one of the nuns would always grab her by the feet and pull her down again. That's pretty neat. Any one of you do that when we're doing the chanting? If you can, don't show off. But if you got into one of those jhanas, sometimes, from what I've read in Christian theology, they call that union with God. It's not God, but you can understand how people interpret that as God. You're not there, disappeared. Incredible bliss and power. Sometimes that bliss is sometimes interpreted as like pure love, like metta love, really pure compassion and bliss. There's hardly any difference between that. It's one of the reasons why that people who get into that first jhana think it's this incredible metta, just the purest form of metta you've ever seen, experienced. But sometimes that love and that bliss are the same. So anyone who experiences those things can very easily come back afterwards and think they're enlightened, union with God, know everything. So that's why some of those samadhi states, especially in the Hindu tradition, are called like the end, that's enlightenment. But of course, that's only the first jhana. As Ronald Reagan used to say, you ain't seen anything yet. There's more to come. There's a bit of a... Oh, is it really a sad thing? Because if you got into a first jhana, if you were a Christian rather than a Buddhist, you'd be a saint. And they name a school after you. Saint Bali, School for Girls. Saint Suwadees, University. Saint Brahms. Has that got a ring to it? Saint Brahms. Cathedral. I don't know why they do that. But anyway, so the samadhi and the first jhana, that first jhana is the first case of sama samadhi. that true, right, correct, appropriate samadhi. So that is really where the interesting stuff happens. And this is not just for monks and nuns. Lay people achieve these states. Otherwise, I'd be wasting my time teaching. You do, and you will. Just a matter of time. So if you don't want jhanas, you better leave soon. Hee hee hee. Okay, so there we go. I could have a time. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.